You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 1st, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner, and author of Milked, How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. Meanwhile, in a shocker, Sarah Palin has lost in Alaska's special election in its first ranked choice voting election to Democrat Mary Haltola, who will be the first Alaska native in Congress. The FDA has authorized the first redesign of the Pfizer and Moderna COVID vaccines targeting the new subvariants of the virus. They should be available as soon as next week. More polls are showing a surge in Biden's approval rating. Quinnipiac has his approval rating at its highest since September of last year. 40% to 52% disapproval compared to 31% to 60% in July. Jackson, Mississippi is still without safe drinking water. An overwhelmingly black city that's been neglected by the state for quite a while and had a shoddy water system for decades because the state, you guessed it, outsourced its infrastructure to a private contractor, which ended up not doing the job, and then there was a lawsuit. So, reports indicate that the DOJ will probably wait until after the midterms to announce any charges against Trump. Does he announce his presidential run before that to subvert that?
Could be.
Trump lawyers are scrambling to cover their butts now that they might have to be witnesses into the probe into Trump's document hoarding. Did they know that their client withheld classified files in defiance of the initial subpoena? Peter Thiel and Mitch McConnell are playing hot potato with Blake Masters' Senate funding. No one wants to pay for this loser's campaign. Sad.
I feel like if he was your teacher's assistant, you should have to pay for his campaign. So Peter Thiel should pony up.
That's the rules. In Pakistan, the WHO is estimating that at least 3 million children are in need of humanitarian assistance due to devastating flooding that will likely spread waterborne disease and cause malnutrition. And lastly, an Israeli court has sentenced the Palestinian leader of a charity, Mohammed El Halabi, Gaza's director for World Vision International, to 12 years in prison. This is a part of them cracking down on NGOs as a way to just continue to subjugate the Palestinian people. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is the Majority Report Thursday. Very excited to be back with you. Let's get right into it here because the midterms are nearing, and I'm quite amused by this story about Blake Masters. Washington Post had a story yesterday about how Peter Thiel and Mitch McConnell are playing hot potato with the funding for Blake Masters' Senate campaign. And no one seems to want to fund this guy. Here's a video for maybe why there's less enthusiasm from the Republican donor side of things to back somebody like this who, in my opinion, has some of the least charisma of any Republican Senate candidate this cycle.
Yeah.
And that's saying a lot.
And let's just be clear about what this is. This is a guy who is seeing the money dry up, seeing his benefactors kind of give him the cold shoulder a little bit. He's had to run away from his original positions on abortion and the stolen election. So now he needs to double to get some people energized with a little bit of edgelordism.
And let's see him attempt that.
Well, this tweet made people mad. Newsweek wrote, oh, Blake said that women and minorities are hurting the economy. Fake news. Look, I don't care if every single employee at the Fed is a black lesbian, as long as they're hired for their competence, not because of what they look like or who they sleep with. News for Joe Biden. We are done with this affirmative action regime. You know, I can't think of a single policy since the end of Jim Crow that's been worse or more divisive for race relations in this country. Race quotas are wrong. Gender quotas are wrong. They're unjust. They're illegal. But the Democrats are addicted to this kind of identity politics garbage. They just care about how you look.
He paused,
not whether
just
you're
right
the best
there.
Quality.
It said identity politics garbage. I'd also say, like, if you're just like some Peter Thiel's teaching assistant from Stanford, you might not be the best expert on the worst policies for Black America since Jim Crow. I mean, I think redlining probably would put itself up there. But anyway, I think he means that, like, this is basically against white people. So
qualified, or whether you can do the best job. You know, if you want to see the affirmative action regime on display, just look at Biden's White House. Biden promised that he would choose a woman for his VP. Then, of course, he chose Kamala Harris. So incompetent, she can't even get a sentence out. But I've never spoken to anyone who can say with a straight face that...
Interesting. I mean, well, first of all, that's a bit of a dog whistle. But would you say that engaging in those kinds of politics is at least reminiscent of identity politics?
I mean, yeah. And he, first of all, he says garbage earlier in the clip. Like, this is not a masterful speaking performance.
Pun intended.
This is beneath the dignity of the Senate office, honestly. Like, this guy looks like a YouTube streamer that, like, is complaining he got a content moderation strike.
He's just, like, doing a poor job of imitating Charlie Kirk and Steven Crowder.
Yeah.
And he's running for Senate against, like, this is not a galvanizing electoral strategy as a way to just, you know, throw jabs at Kamala Harris's speaking ability. It's one thing if you're Trump and you have that cachet. It's another thing if you're somebody who can't even hold my attention as I'm doing a show watching him, like, speak right there. He is not, he does not have any fundamental underpinning that's going to have him have success, just essentially because he was propped up by a guy like Peter Thiel, as a way to, I don't know, serve those kinds of interests.
Yeah, he's a courtier, and Peter Thiel tried to give him a position.
And now he's abandoning him, which is the funniest part of this year. So this is from the Washington Post. After J.D. Vance won the Republican primary for Senate in Ohio, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell called Peter Thiel, the billionaire investor who had pumped $15 million into a super PAC backing Vance, to congratulate him, but also to make a request. Since McConnell's resources were limited, a.k.a. he's giving money to candidates he thinks are more likely to win, the senator said, would Thiel continue to finance Vance through the general election? Thiel demurred, according to a person familiar with the May exchange who, like others interviewed for this article, spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe private discussions. Essentially, the Washington Post writes, in the ensuing weeks, a high-stakes game of chicken would play out between McConnell and Thiel. This is over the past few months, culminating in the move last Friday by a super PAC linked to the minority leader, the Senate Leadership Fund, to abandon about $8 million worth of TV, radio, and digital ads originally booked to boost Masters. The move was preceded by a pair of phone calls last week in which Thiel spoke to McConnell and the Kentucky Republicans' top fundraising lieutenant, Stephen Law, who heads the Senate Leadership Fund. McConnell told Thiel over the phone last week that Vance's race in Ohio was proving more costly for the Senate Leadership Fund than anticipated.
Hilarious.
Another Peter Thiel...
Boy,
yeah. I was going to say apprentice, but boy is more apt. That money was not unlimited, and that there was a need for the billionaire to come in a big way in Arizona, as a person familiar with the conversations described his words. Mm. Law, in a call with Thiel the day before his group cut back on the Arizona ads, expressed concern about Masters as a candidate and pessimism about his company's campaign's viability. Both Vance and Masters are friends and former business associates of Thiel's. Masters stepped down from roles and But essentially, the article goes on to describe that, or this detail's too good for me to skip over. The message from McConnell and Law, according to people with knowledge of their pitch, was that they should essentially split the cost, with Thiel cutting a check to their super PAC matching whatever funds they put behind Masters. Another option, these people said, was that the Thiel-funded super PAC could take over the ad reservations initially made by the McConnell-linked group. Thiel indicated to them that he was not interested in such arrangements.
No, thank you.
A posture, say, people around the venture capitalist that is informed by his approach of investing early and a belief that any more of his money would be used as a Democratic talking point. He is still hosting fundraisers for Masters in the coming weeks. He flooded the primary process with money. And now in the general election, he's leaving his guy hanging him out to dry because he doesn't believe in it.
That's so funny, his investment strategy of investing early in companies and then getting out. Like, you got lucky with some investments early on, but we have to start asking the question, if both Vance and Masters lose, you know, we all have just reason to suspect like Peter Thiel of being basically a fascist or monarchist type of guy. Or is he a secret Democrat putting up these little little Silicon Valley boys to, secure the Senate for the Democrats? And all maybe that's what Greenwald was doing all along too, when he was retweeting Blake Masters and J.D. Vance campaign ads. Maybe he was just helping the Democrats.
Long undercover campaign, the two of them.
Thanks, guys.
It is just wonderful to watch McConnell and Peter Thiel, like two crappy divorced parents fighting over, if they're going to have the custody of their kid for the weekend because they'd rather be out like partying or something like that. I'd rather be spending my money on my boat. That's the vibe I get. So, yeah, Thiel can spend it all he wants, but he basically says, hey, you're on your own now, dude. I'm not helping you out, even though they're supposed to be immensely close. Both Vance and Masters are getting thrown under the bus by this guy.
And they are not independent of him at all. No more money is going to change anything. Everybody knows that the only career experience Blake Masters have is basically compiling Peter Thiel's Do a Monopoly lectures at Stanford into a book.
Yeah.
And that's all he's ever done. That's his entire thing. So it doesn't matter if you stop giving him money. Everyone knows he's just your teaching assistant and you're trying to make him a senator. Good luck with that. You should cough it up, Peter.
Yeah, and people already know that. And no amount of money being given to him in the general election would change that perception.
No.
It's just such a flimsy excuse.
That's all
but people the hilarious
know about
one.
Him. Yeah.
And the other story I wanted to highlight at the top of the show was I mentioned the Sarah Palin loss in the special election. Now, this was Alaska's first ranked choice election. And it was a special election for Don Young's seat, who passed away. He held that office for nearly 50 years. It's Alaska's lone House seat. And now Alaska has joined Maine as the first two states to elect someone to Congress with ranked choice voting, which is interesting. I mean, Maine is experimental in this kind of way, but Alaska, some of these states with smaller populations, you see them making some of these gambles. And in this instance, it really did pay off. One, because Sarah Palin, who's a total clown, lost. But two, because the ranked choice system appears to have worked as intended. Most of the voters in Alaska used their first choice on one of the Republican candidates. There was another candidate named Nick Begich, and he was there a lot of voters' second choices. But in terms of, if I'm getting this right, his first choice voters, a lot of them did not rank Sarah Palin as their second choice, which in the second round of voting allowed it to break in the way in favor of the Democratic candidate Peltola, who is a former state lawmaker and will be, I believe, the first Alaskan native representative from Alaska, and she's a Democrat. Palin was already vulnerable because according to polling in Alaska, the 3 in 5 Alaskans have a negative view of her. And that's kind of amazing, given the fact that her celebrity was so tied to her identity in Alaska. But, like, she left the governor's office early. She decided to have a reality show. Totally messy. Totally incompetent. And it seems like, despite the state being red, people understood that.
I mean, there's in all these sort of Western states, I mean, North Dakota is a similar thing too. Like, there's a big distrust of like the big city media and that sort of stuff. And she just went to hang out in Fox News green rooms instead of doing her job.
And like, apparently with active COVID, eating in Upper East Side restaurants, despite claiming to be unvaccinated. Her relationship with Alaska is half-assed. And it seems like voters understood that. But here are some clips. They're a little too small. I wish the reporter had kept filming for a little while.
Yeah, give us the raw footage, guys.
But you get a glimpse of Sarah Palin as she starts to understand that she's losing, and she begins to spiral, blaming ranked choice voting in general.
Ooh, role plays.
Voting. Yeah. When it comes down to second and third place votes, that's going to decide who's going to win. I mean, really? Alaskans want Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi.
That's kind of just a little bit of it. And then here's a video of her as she realized that she's essentially lost, because I think that was as votes were coming in. She's cutting this cake. Spirits trying to keep them high. She's realizing that I'm going to lose this election.
This cake isn't going to taste as good as you wanted it to.
Surprise, but knowing that the task in front of me is to explain to Alaskans why ranked choice voting is not in the public's best interest.
Oh!
Do Alaskans really want to be like I
said? So, I mean, she's ranting about ranked choice voting.
Ranked choice losers.
Yeah. Sorry, that was the system. Those were the rules. This is like when Hillary Clinton was saying, well, I won the popular vote, but lady, you didn't go to the states, like, you didn't go to Michigan, you didn't go to Wisconsin. Those were the rules.
You understood.
You understood that this was the system. You had to win in the electoral college, not in the popular vote.
Also, this is just objectively a better system. I'm not one of these people who thinks, like, electoral reform, like, getting rid of first past the post is the only thing politics needs or even, like, the main thing we should emphasize. Because I think, like, the New York mayor race had a bad example of that going wrong, for instance. But it is objectively better than first past the post.
But look at New York 10. Say if we had had ranked choice voting in that instance, one, you know, the progressive should have consolidated behind Eileen New. But another point to be made is that, you know, a lot of people would have made her second choice if they voted for Mondaire Jones or Carolina Rivera.
Right. Like, strategically think about it. Like, it's obviously not empirical, but you could not, I would never ever think that a number one Carolina Rivera voter or Mondaire Jones voter or even Liz Holtman and Joanne Simon were putting Daniel Goldman second.
Right. But no, yeah, exactly.
I think he would have been out after his first choice votes, honestly.
Yeah.
The 50% of progressive candidates that got those votes of like 5 or 6 people.
Right. I mean, we need to, I think, again, it's not number one priority, as you say, Matt, but this should be a system that begins to be replicated throughout the country. In New York, the reason we had it for the mayor's race and not for the federal races is because it's only applying right now to citywide races.
It was via ballot measure for the city that we New Yorkers voted to, you know.
But I want this more for federal elections, right?
And Sarah Palin should ask herself why so many people left her off their rankings. that's a simple question.
That would be a little bit too introspective for me. But yeah, so that's it's a good result there. And there will be another election. This is a special election, but for the time being, this is a success. And
why did she run again?
Cause what else is she going to do?
Dried up. Yeah.
Tom Cotton was already tweeting about how ranked choice voting is a way to steal elections. So that's going to be their new talking point about this. And then I saw some Axios guys saying that the ranked choice system was, it's so convoluted that it undercuts faith in the electoral process. So maybe we shouldn't do it altogether. Enough.
Oh, yeah, bullshit.
Yeah, right. No, we create more democratic systems and infrastructure. And it's like saying we shouldn't, it was like that take that Andrew Yang had that we shouldn't target Trump with an investigation because of what the blowback might be. No. That's, you don't make systemic decisions or big decisions about law and about election structures based on potential blowback. That's the language of losers and weakness.
Yeah, make Election Day a national holiday and people are going to have time to brush up on it.
Biden should do that, by the way. I think, you know, it needs to go through Congress, apparently. But hey, hold the vote. With that said, we have a message from our sponsor before we get to our next guest. And I think the audience might enjoy this ad read. Isn't it crazy that in 2022, stop laughing, Bradley. We still have high-speed internet, celebrities going to space, and electric cars, and yet people are still cleaning their bums the way our Victorian brothers and sisters did. With toilet paper? Come on. Step into the 21st century and upgrade your bathroom routine and start washing your bum with Hello Tushy bidets. Because smearing your business around with toilet paper is so 100 years ago. The Hello Tushy bidet attachment washes your bum with fresh water for a way better clean than toilet paper. Simply spray and pat dry. It attaches to your existing toilet. No electrician or plumber needed. It's very, very easy. It installs in less than 8 minutes and cuts down on your TP use by 80%, which saves you money and paper waste. I mean, think about how much money you spend on toilet paper every year. And then you'll quickly come to the conclusion that investing in the Hello Tushy bidet is probably more cost efficient, definitely more cost efficient. Hello Tushy has cleaned over 1 million happy bums. I want all of our listeners to have clean bums. That is my ultimate desire for you. Visit HelloTushy.com. Tushy is spelled TUSHY.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping right now. That's HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off, and tag at HelloTushy on social media so they can celebrate your clean bum with you. That's HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner and author of Milked, How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined now by Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner and author of Milked, How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. Ruth, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be with you.
Of course. So your book centers around reporting that you did both in Wisconsin and in Mexico, where you lived for a while. And it's on the role of immigrants in the dairy industry in the U.S. What was the genesis of this idea? How did you come to wanting to write about it?
Well, my family and I went to live in Mexico for a year right after Trump took office. We decided to take the kids there to get away from the United States, to have kind of a cultural immersion experience. And it was a great year. And just as we were leaving, I read a news article in Wisconsin about Mexican workers who were packing up and driving all the way back to Mexico from Wisconsin dairy farms where they had been working for decades. Things had gotten uglier politically. They were getting yelled at in the street. They felt uncomfortable. The parents were undocumented and the children were afraid their parents would be snatched off the street. So there was a particular family that this article centered on, And it really captured my attention, partly because that was where I first learned that 80% of the labor on Wisconsin dairy farms is performed by undocumented immigrants, mostly from Mexico, which is a huge number, and I think not well understood. So I found this family when I was down in Mexico. I found the same truck that they'd driven all the way back from Wisconsin on the street, and saw the house that they had built with the money they made milking cows, and became aware of this long-term relationship between people who lived in these little mountain towns in Veracruz, Mexico, and people in rural Wisconsin, the dairy farmers who really depend on their labor and have been working with them for many years, about two decades.
So what does some of that work look like in terms of hours and how difficult it is, and also just the relationship between some of these workers with their employer?
It's hard physical labor. You know, people are working from 4 o'clock in the morning until 6, 7 at night. They're mucking out barns. They're cleaning up manure. They're attaching the milking equipment to cows' udders and milking the cows. And what's interesting is they started doing this a couple of decades ago because farms, Wisconsin is the number one state in the union for farm bankruptcies. And part of what has driven that is that there's this enormous pressure to get big or get out. And so little family farms have been going under at the rate of one or two a day, and the ones that have survived have had to grow very rapidly. So around the year 2000 in the late 90s, a lot of small family farmers who had never employed anybody but their own family members before began hiring workers. Couldn't find workers locally who wanted to do these long, grueling jobs, and found some Mexican workers who were working as seasonal employees on local Christmas tree farms. And that was the beginning of a relationship that has become absolutely essential to the dairy industry here.
So can you talk and expand a little bit more on the fact that all of these larger farms seem to be edging out smaller farms at this rapid rate in Wisconsin, and where, when that began, and honestly, too, how farming subsidies from a federal level play into that consolidation?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is that there's been a shift over many years, accelerated by global trade agreements like NAFTA, to creating crops and milk as a commodity that's traded on the global market, instead of sort of local food systems where this food is sold locally and prices are sort of measurable, sustainable, they follow a regular cycle. Instead, you've got this tremendous global economy, this huge pressure on farmers to grow giant soybean crops, to grow corn. Under NAFTA, the United States dumped a lot of subsidized corn on Mexico, and that drove a lot of Mexican farmers off their land, and that created this rush of immigration across the border as people were looking for jobs after they lost their farms. What's interesting is that these two groups of rural people in the United States and Mexico are really under pressure from these same global economic forces. And they have that in common. And that's sort of contrary to the political narrative of rural voters in the Midwest voting for Donald Trump and, you know, buying into a lot of the Republican anti-immigration rhetoric, which they do. A lot of the farmers in my book were Trump voters, but they really depend on and appreciate the undocumented workers who are coming to do these jobs. And they know that those workers are not replacing anybody. Replacement theory having been popularized in part by our U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, the idea that these workers are coming and taking Americans' jobs, they could not find Americans to do these jobs. So I feel like getting at that relationship and understanding both on, you know, the sort of personal relationship level and the huge economic relationship level, what the reality is, it really kind of unravels that anti-immigrant narrative.
It's just amazing that I'm sure Ron Johnson and Republicans, lawmakers in Wisconsin, have an understanding that migrant workers are absolutely essential to these businesses remaining afloat, these farms. And yet it is his rhetoric on border hawkishness is up there with anybody.
Yeah, and Ron Johnson has been rushing down to the border, warning darkly about this, you know, open border and these immigrants rushing across. And meanwhile, in his state, his, you know, this major industry, dairy, is that, you know, we were the dairy state until California surpassed us in volume, but it's a huge deal in Wisconsin, is 80% dependent on these people's labor. So it is, it's really contrary to reality. And one thing that really illustrates that, I think, is in our governor's race this year, the Republican candidate, Tim Michaels, is a construction company executive. And when he was the head of the road builders lobby, that lobby group pushed really hard not to penalize employers for hiring undocumented immigrants. And the reason is they are heavily dependent on undocumented labor. Yeah. And yet he brags about building the prototype for Trump's border wall. And he has the same very harsh anti-immigrant rhetoric that a lot of Republicans have. And they know better.
So you mentioned that ironically, the struggle of Mexican farmers and what some of these Wisconsin dairy farms are undergoing is quite similar due to globalization and NAFTA. Can you talk a bit more about how many jobs Mexico lost after NAFTA and how that affected migration coming to the United States in search of jobs?
Well, about 900,000 Mexican farmers were driven off their land, subsistence farmers, directly after NAFTA and the dumping of cheap corn that was subsidized corn from the United States. So that is one number. I mean, there are many other statistics about that trade deal, but what that directly created was migration to Mexico City and other big cities in Mexico, and migration across the border, which has been a reality since, you know, we created the Bracero program in this country to recognize that we were relying on Mexican workers to come seasonally and harvest crops in the United States. So it's not a new idea that Mexican workers come work here for a while, send money home, and then go back. And in fact, remittances from the United States, Mexican workers' wages that they're sending back home, are the largest source of foreign income. It's about $50 billion. It's more than the income from petroleum in this petroleum country. So it's a long-standing economic reality. What has happened in this case in the dairy industry is that workers are staying to do year-round jobs, and there is no year-round visa for low-skilled work by immigrants in the United States. So that's why almost every worker on a dairy farm in the United States and any year-round agricultural worker is here without documents.
And NAFTA paired with increased border hawkishness also has resulted in an interruption of what used to be more circular migration, where workers would come across the border, make money, and then return. Can you talk about those two policy choices kind of creating these very specific set of conditions that make things really difficult for migrant workers in this country?
Yeah, it's ironic because the moral panic over immigrants coming to the United States, immigrants who, by the way, have a much lower rate of committing crimes than people who were born here. So that moral panic is really, it's very hyped up. It has created a militarized border, which makes it both dangerous and expensive to cross. And so when people come here, they don't go back and forth as much as they used to. The pattern now is for people to stay for a very long time, which is painful for families that are separated for years and years. And it creates this strange situation where we have U.S. industries that are absolutely reliant on these workers. The workers cross, you know, in the trunk of a car, walking across the desert, you know, take these dangerous crossings, pay about $11,000 to do it, work for most of a year to pay back that money that they borrow from relatives and friends, and then stay here for a decade or two decades, because once they go back, there's no guarantee they're ever coming to the United States again. And they're sending money home to these villages that I visited with a group of farmers from Wisconsin who go every year to see the families of their undocumented workers, where they are building roads, houses, businesses, supporting this whole community with money that they're sending home from the farms in the United States.
It is. It just is jarring because it sounds counterintuitive to people, because of so many decades of fear-mongering about the border. But the fact of the matter is that more heavily militarizing the border creates more, I'm using this term just because that's what they would use, illegal immigration, in terms of just like, as opposed to a more fluid border system where it would be less treacherous, people would die less. I mean, people die, get maimed trying to cross the border. And also, it would serve, I mean, from the dairy farmer's perspective or from other farmers' perspectives, it would serve them better to in a sense.
Absolutely. I mean, it makes more, it creates more illegal immigrants in the United States in two ways. One is people stay here longer who want to go back and would rather be going back to see their families and have the option to come across. But secondly, it just makes a system illegal that is economically a reality and has been for decades. And U.S. industries, not just agriculture, more than anybody agriculture, but also construction, food service, hospitality. They know it. They know that they're depending on these people, that they can't find Americans to do these jobs. And so just declaring that illegal instead of making it possible for people to do it legally creates a bunch of people who are, you know, in their status is not legal, and that's not necessary.
And also, I would imagine, by the wages in and of itself, but also the conditions, it creates a bit of a treacherous situation from a work perspective for some, for a lot of these workers who are getting paid way too little, working way too hard, and don't have recourse from the government. It's almost like they're invisible, but it's scary.
Yeah. I mean, people have no protection. They're really right. Vulnerable. And they're vulnerable to wage theft and abuse. And there's some of that in my book. But what really most interested me was actually the very warm relationship between the farmers and the workers in my book, because they see themselves as having some real similarities. And the farmers, when they go back on these trips, they describe seeing scenes of neighbors helping neighbors to build homes and kind of all pitching in and doing this work as something like a scene from their own childhood in the 1960s in rural Wisconsin, where those farms are disappearing. You drive down the highway and you don't see cows from the road anymore. They're all indoors. You know, there's a whole way of life that's fading very rapidly on both sides of the border. And here are these people who see themselves as having this agrarian background in common. And that I found really interesting.
So yeah, talk a bit about more some of those stories of people that you spoke with and your books is centered around, both in terms of your time in Mexico and your time in reporting in Wisconsin.
Well, my book opens with this 70-year-old farmer, Stan Linder, who drives down every year. He's been going on this trip since 2001, when the trip started because a local Spanish teacher at a small town high school in Alma, Wisconsin, she was translating on the farms, and she started taking the farmers down to try to learn Spanish in Mexico. And then they began going every year to visit the families of their workers because it made such a deep impression on them. So he drives down there every year. And when I went on the trip, we went into a restaurant in Veracruz, and these two women came running up to him and hugged him and brought him a bottle of tequila. And Stan and his granddaughter sat down and polished off this whole bottle of tequila between them. These women were making fun of them, making fun of their Spanish, teasing them kind of gently. But it was a long-term relationship that they had had. And the women, Luisa Tepole and Blanca Hernandez, had worked in Minnesota and Wisconsin for years and years milking cows, and now have started businesses in this town, welcome these farmers every year. I spoke on the cell phone from the school supply store that one of them set up, Luisa Tepole, with a farmer in Minnesota who had hired her. And he said, you know, these people are just the salt of the earth, that I could not have done. I couldn't have done what I've done without them. I really needed her and her sister and the other people who came from that town to work here. And the farmers themselves kind of had this fascinating experience going to parties that were thrown for them in these towns and seeing more of a subsistence lifestyle. And like I said, sort of recognizing something from their own childhood that they felt nostalgic about there. So it's interesting. You know, it's an interesting close relationship. I think it shows how people are not just political labels, because these are rural Trump voters. They helped put Trump over the top in 2016. But they're not anti-immigrant. And there's a more complex relationship there.
And the complexity, I think, is also reflected in terms of just, I focus on the lower wages, right? And some of those, the fact that these workers should be getting paid more. But part of the issue with it as well is that the farmers themselves are being squeezed out by these larger conglomerates. Can you talk about that dynamic and how that trickles down, affects both the smaller farms and the workers, despite the fact that there is like this small, almost family farming relationship between some of the workers and their employers?
Yeah, I mean, in Wisconsin, which is the number one state in the United States for farm bankruptcies, one of the statistics that's sort of fascinating from the state agriculture department is that as we have lost about half of our family farms since 2007, the number of cows has stayed exactly the same. So those cows are no longer on 50-cow, 100-cow family farms. They're on 8,000 cow, 30,000 cow, giant operations. And that is a very different landscape. And it comes with a lot of environmental costs and food system costs, you know. And it's where my book ends up going is talking about how do we restore a more livable, humane economy where people don't have to leave Mexico for two decades and leave their children behind to earn money up here in this very tenuous setup. And wait for their life to begin as they keep sending home money, which is really hard on people. And how do farmers sustain themselves? And how do we have a food system that's not so vulnerable? Because during the pandemic, we saw how vulnerable our far-flung food system really is. So setting up working local economies, food economies, in both in Mexico and the United States is a, you know, it's a goal of something called the food sovereignty movement and people who would like to retain that smaller scale agricultural way of life.
In terms of maintaining that, what is the hope there, given the fact that it seems like some of these larger conglomerates have been unshackled, and when they have relationships with stores that are behemoths like Walmart or can't think of another example off the top of my head right now. I don't know. But stores like that, it's difficult to I guess breathe life back into some of these more sustainable systems.
Yeah, I mean, there have been some successful efforts. Organic Valley is one of them, based in Wisconsin, which is a nationwide food cooperative that's been very successful. It started with vegetables and is now mostly focused on dairy. Helping,
it makes me feel good. That's my milk of choice. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, helping farmers make a reasonable income from selling their product. I think in organics, you've seen some of that. You've also seen Walmart get into the organic area, and that is causing the same kind of consolidation and price undercutting that happened in conventional food. But I think that is one answer, is that kind of cooperative movement. Another answer, of course, is to just have a legal year-round visa for workers so that that takes some of the pressure off the immigration aspect of it and the exploitation of people. And then another answer is just for consumers to be more aware that, you know, paying really low prices for food has a really big cost in terms of environmental, the air we breathe, the water, particularly in Wisconsin, that's poisoned now by these CAFOs that are dumping manure into our water. And for people. So if you buy artisanal cheese from a small local producer, that's a really different economic model from going to, you know, Kraft at the grocery store.
Right. And in terms of I wanted actually quickly to return to some of the worker experience as well, because I am It is just, I feel like most Americans don't fundamentally understand, one, what it's like in terms of being vulnerable to wage theft, not making so much money, doing all of this hard labor, but also the threat of deportation and having that all ripped out from under you. What in your reporting did you find was the employer's response to, say, their employees potentially, or how employers set up their worker systems to prevent their employees from being deported, and what were some of the employees' fears about that happening to them?
Well, in Wisconsin, the state legislature took away driver's licenses from undocumented people in 2007. So since that time, a lot of workers have moved onto the farm because it's dangerous to drive. A lot of drivers, you know, they're driving trucks anyway. They're going into town to get groceries. They get pulled over. Farmers are outraged. They go to court to bail out their employees, and they feel really angry that the local sheriffs are setting up traps to catch people who look Latino. So that's one effect. And that's one farmer response. There have been ICE raids in Wisconsin. There were many more of them during the Trump administration than there are now, but that has driven some people to just decide to leave, particularly people with US born children, like the family that I first went and saw in Mexico, who had two little boys who were born in Wisconsin. They started school in Mexico and their classmates made fun of them for speaking Spanish with a Wisconsin accent. Their parents were from Mexico, but they were from here. And I talked to a young woman, a teenager, Jaziz, who grew up mostly in Wisconsin and has really fond memories and is back in Mexico, got stopped at the border and can't come back, and misses her dad. And that's caused a lot of heartache in her life. He's still here. She's down there. You know, the fear of deportation is just hanging over people all the time. And there's a town in Wisconsin called Arcadia where the largest furniture manufacturer in the world has its corporate headquarters. And they employ a lot of undocumented immigrants. There were major ICE raids in that area. And there was a successful lawsuit by an immigrant rights group called Voces de la Frontera that stopped that company from telling people they couldn't discuss their immigration status or their troubles with the employer with each other. And that was a major advance. And that town is becoming a mostly Hispanic town. I mean, it's been revitalized. There are a lot of Mexican stores, grocery stores, and restaurants on Main Street. The school would have closed because of low enrollment, because of rural depopulation, but it's instead thriving with about 80% Spanish-speaking students. So that's kind of fascinating, too, as you see the transformation of these little towns because of this immigrant population. And you know, in one generation, people are U.S. citizens, and they could end up being political leaders as well as business leaders, which is an interesting prospect. It doesn't take that long.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just returning in my mind to some of the insane outrage after some progressive lawmakers were calling to abolish ICE, as if ICE is this storied institution in the United States that wasn't created 20 years ago. And we obviously understand that its usefulness is, well, you could argue it was never useful, but certainly outlived it. And they've now become just a force to terrorize and break up families, as you say.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's just, upsetting. But you talked a bit about how low-wage work, there's no eligibility for visas, which is really crazy because this would solve a lot of these problems. What is the reasoning behind that? Is it more just some of the rhetoric saying we want the best of the best coming into the country? We want doctors. You'll see that even on the Democratic side, that kind of rhetoric. What is the structure of the visa system that precludes that?
Well, it grows out of this World War II era Bracero program, which was a seasonal program. So agricultural workers are allowed to come to the United States and follow the crop harvest and go back. They can't stay for a full calendar year. There is no visa category that acknowledges that kind of work is going on. So it's just antiquated. And as far as immigration reform goes, it would be very easy to just create this category of visa. And I think the reason that it hasn't happened is that ever since comprehensive immigration reform fell apart in about 2014, blocked by Republicans, there was this moment when there was this bipartisan consensus. We have to fix our broken immigration system. We have to acknowledge the dependence of employers on these folks, and we need to do something better. But since all of the pieces of that were lined up and then fell apart, it's been very hard to get consensus back together on any individual piece. And part of the problem is that immigrant rights activists are afraid that if we get one little piece, then we will never get justice for DACA recipients. We will never get a path to citizenship. We'll just allow farmers to employ workers year-round milking their cows. So, I mean, that's part of the...
But hopefully, if there was more sunlight on this, then their wage theft would be lessened. There would hopefully be some less exploitative practices. That I feel like is a one of the solutions that we could be achieved here, you know?
Yeah, and I also think that Republicans really need to lose some elections with this anti-immigrant rhetoric, because there are a lot of rural voters who are, you know, in very slim margins in Wisconsin, putting Republicans over the top, and who don't agree with that rhetoric. And so I think really showing how hypocritical and wrong it is really important.
That brings me to Ron Johnson. I would be remiss if I did not ask you to expand on some of the points you made about him earlier, particularly because, like, this dude is in a tough re-election fight, tougher than I think some people anticipated. Mandela Barnes is a great candidate, but you know, this guy, he said he was not going to run for a third term, and he's just doing it anyway. I can't get over that. I feel like that would be something easy to run on. Like, this, he's a total liar. But what is what has been on the ground in Wisconsin some of the reaction that you've seen? Because he is a candidate. He's a Republican who could lose despite his anti-immigrant rhetoric, or maybe because of it in part.
He's a vulnerable incumbent. And that's very interesting. And he was really Trump's chief enabler in the U.S. Senate. So he's famous for saying all kinds of wacky things, like, if you get a COVID shot, it might kill you, and, you know, beware. And the replacement theory, he denies promoting this white supremacist replacement theory, but he does use language that definitely pushes those buttons. He's always talking about the threat of illegal immigration. What's interesting in Wisconsin is that he's underwater. He's behind about 7 points in the polls. And in the latest poll, really interestingly, our very dynamic young African-American Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes is up by 14 points among independents, who are evenly divided between Republican-leaning and Democratic-leaning independents. So these are the types of people that I talked to from my book, farmers who voted for Barack Obama and Donald Trump, people who liked Bernie Sanders and who voted for Trump because he was throwing a rock at a system that has not served them well. And so I think understanding that that's a real possibility in Wisconsin, that maverick candidates are often very popular here. Russ Feingold was a popular U.S. senator replaced by Ron Johnson. People see Ron Johnson's unforced errors as a sign of authenticity. And I think that sort of partly feeds into that. But independents prefer Mandela Barnes. And you really can have the same voters who vote for a aggressive right winger like Johnson turn around and vote for a progressive candidate. So I think that the answer to Ron Johnson is not sort of a mealy-mouthed moderate who kind of tries to walk a line. You have farmers who are really angry about NAFTA, and they really like hearing from Barnes, who's quite progressive. So yeah, it'll be it's a tight race. It's an interesting race. And I think that Johnson is very vulnerable.
Has his role in January 6th been something that people have used against him, just anecdotally, or you know, see that as a negative for him approaching the November election?
It's just hard because people are so siloed. So of course, Democrats are outraged that he tried to turn over the fake ballots for Trump after Wisconsin's electoral ballots for Biden were already submitted. And Mike Pence's office refused to accept them from Johnson. And he made comments that he was not the least bit worried about the January 6th insurrection, that the people who were storming the Capitol were good people. If they had been Black Lives Matter protesters, that would have worried him. I mean, he says awful stuff like that, but he's said so many ridiculous things and been reelected that I think the Democratic Party has decided they're running against him on the fact that he's out of touch with Wisconsinites. He says things like, we need to renegotiate Medicare and Social Security in the budget every year. We shouldn't guarantee those programs. I'm not sure why he thinks that's a winning thing to say. He's against unemployment insurance expansion. He's a libertarian. You know, he thought that COVID was only going to kill, you know, 3 million people maybe, so there's no reason why we shouldn't reopen business. He just does the stuff that shows that he's completely out of touch with his constituents. So I think those are the things that are more likely to bring him down than the tinfoil hat conspiracy stuff, which he's famous for.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, I guess. Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner. I've now almost said Washington Examiner three times here. Author of Milked, How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. Thanks so much for your time today, Ruth. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. All right. With that said, folks, we're going to wrap up the free part of this program. But first, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, some fun stuff. There's a live show October 23rd at the Terragram Ballroom with This Is Revolution, Give Them Argument, and Left Reckoning. Also last night, well, we did chat with some Solidarity and Above patrons for Left Reckoning. It was really fun. We had a Zoom in which a bunch of members joined, including Kowalski, again, from his tractor, and we saw the dried-up Platte River, which is a horrifying sight.
Yeah.
This weekend we're going to be talking to you Garls about Trump's legal jeopardy, and tomorrow I'll be releasing a conversation on the Lex stream, maybe tonight, I'm not sure, with Dr. Eric Osgood about COVID vaccines, the new vaccines, vaccine harms, and things like that. So you'll want to check that out.
Yes, you will. All right. Do we have Binder and... Not yet. All right, that's fine. They'll be joining us shortly. Check out Doomed. Check out Scam Economy. The wonderful twin shows that the illustrious Matt Binder is the proprietor of. And The Discourse, which is Brandon Sutton's show. We will be joined by them in the fun half, where we will be taking your calls and reading your IMs. 646-257-3920 is the phone number. Also, just a reminder, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 15% off, if I remember accurately. That's it. Okay, good. You can get some great coffee. I've been getting their cold brew beans for a little while now. And when I have that big purple or blue mug, that's what's in that. And that's when I'm really caffeinated. I'm pretty caffeinated today, though. So all over the place right now. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? This me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that
one. Libertarian.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3551. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop. You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the weak being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I,
I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.